Vox Populi. Your voice online for people, parapolitics and the planet.
How will we catch the next Timothy McVeigh? Did anyone suggest that all blonde-haired, blue-eyed, white Christian men should be rounded up in this country?
If you're of color and you support this administration, and if you think that Condoleezza Rice says something profound, I think you need to take a stark, hard look in the mirror and then ask yourself if what she said wasn't one of the biggest insults to African people in this country that you have ever heard.
If the FBI hadn't been too busy chasing elves, Bin Laden or whoever did September 11th would have had to try and pull it off with five guys instead of 19.
It doesn't exactly get light in the morning at Cletus. It just gradually stops being dark.
Yes. Yes, yes. Us people are just poems. We're 90% metaphor, with a leanness of meaning approaching hyperdistillation. And once upon a time, we were moonshine, rushing down the throat of a giraffe. Yes, rushing down the long hall, despite what the PA announcement says. Yes, rushing down the long hall, down the long stairs in a building so tall that it will always be there. It's part of a pair. There on the bow of Noah's Ark, the most prestigious couple just kicking back, parked against a perfectly blue sky. On a morning beatific in its Indian summer breeze. On the day that America fell to its knees after strutting around for a century without saying thank you or please. And the shock was subsonic and the smoke was deafening between the setup and the punchline. Because we were all on time for work that day. And we all boarded that plane for to fly. And then while the fires were raging, we all climbed up on the windowsill, and then we all held hands and jumped into the sky. And every burrow looked up when it heard the first blast, and then every dumb action movie was summarily surpassed, and the exodus uptown by foot and motor car looked more like war than anything I've seen so far. So far. So far. So fierce and ingenious, a poetic specter so far gone that every jackass newscaster was struck dumb and stumbling over, oh my God, and this is unbelievable, and on and on. And I'll tell you what, while we're at it, you can keep the Pentagon, you can keep the propaganda, you can keep each and every TV that's been trying to convince me to participate in some prep school punk's plan to perpetuate retribution. Perpetuate retribution. Even as the blue toxic smoke of our lesson in retribution is still hanging in the air, and there's ash on our shoes, and there's ash in our hair, and there's a fine silt on every mantle from Hell's Kitchen to Brooklyn, and the streets are full of stories of twists and near misses, and soon every open bar is crammed to the rafters with tales of narrowly averted disasters, and the whiskey is flowing like never before. As all over the country, folks just shake their heads and pour. So here's a toast to all the folks that live in Palestine, Afghanistan, Iraq, El Salvador. Here's a toast to all the folks living on the Pine Ridge Reservation under the stone-cold gaze of Mount Rushmore. Here's a toast to all those nurses and doctors who daily provide women with a choice, who stand down a threat the size of Oklahoma City just to listen to a young woman's voice. Here's a toast to all those folks on death row right now, awaiting the executioner's guillotine, who are shackled there with dread and can only escape into their heads to find peace in the form of a dream. Because take away our PlayStations, and we are a third world nation under the thumb of some blue blood royal son who stole the Oval Office in that phony election. It don't take a weatherman to look around and see the weather. Jeb said he'd deliver Florida, and boy, did he ever. And we hold these truths to be self-evident. Number one, George W. Bush is not president. Number two, America is not a true democracy. And number three, the media is not fooling me, because I am a poem heeding hyperdistillation, and I've got no room for a lie. So verbose. I'm looking out over my whole human family, and I'm raising my glass in a toast. Here's to our last drink of fossil fuels. May we vow to get off of this sauce. Shoo away the swarms of commuter planes and find that train ticket we lost. Because once upon a time, the line followed the river and peeked into all the backyards, and the laundry was waving and the graffiti was teasing us from brick walls and bridges, and we were rolling over ridges through valleys under stars. I dream of touring like Duke Ellington in my own railroad car. I dream of waiting on the tall blonde wooden benches in a grand station aglow with grace, and then standing out on the platform and feeling the air on my face. Give back the night its distant whistle. Give the darkness back its soul. Give the big oil companies the finger, finally, and relearn how to rock and roll. Yes, the lessons are all around us, and change is waiting there. So it's time to pick through the streets, clean the streets, clear the air. It's time to get our government to pull its big dick out of the sand of someone else's desert. Put its back in its pants. Quit the hypocritical chants of freedom forever. Because when one lone phone rang in 2001 at 10 after 9 on 911, which was the number we all called when that lone phone rang right off the wall, right off our desk and down the long hall, down the long stairs in a building so tall that the whole world turned just to watch it fall. And while we're at it, remember the first time around? The bomb, the rider truck, the parking garage, the princess that didn't even feel the pee. Remember joking around in our apartment on Avenue D? Can you imagine how many paper coffee cups would have to change their design following a fantastical reversal of the New York skyline? It was a joke. At the time. And that was just a few years ago. So let the record show that the FBI was all over that case, that the plot was obvious and in all of our face. And scoping that scene religiously, the CIA, or is it KGB, committing countless crimes against humanity with this kind of eventuality as its excuse for abuse after expensive abuse, and they didn't have a clue. Look, another window to see through. Way up here, on the 104th floor. Look, another key, another door. 10% literal. 90% metaphor. 3,000 some poems disguised as people on an almost too perfect day. Must be more than pawns in some asshole's passion play. So now it's your job and it's my job to make it that way, to make sure they didn't die in vain. Hear the train.
what a dreadful irony. Victor Jara singing midst the tortured and the dead. White House glasses clinking as I end his comrade's bled.
After that rather long lead-in, welcome to this, our second Vox Populi podcast. That was Attila the Stockbroker with Death of a Salesman. Any of you lucky enough to live in the Manchester area, that's Manchester in the UK, not Manchester, Arizona or God knows where, can see Attila the Stockbroker perform live at the M19 bar on Stockport Road, Levenshulme, I think that's the way it's pronounced, on Thursday the 23rd of November. Don't miss that if you are in that neck of the woods. I wish I could be there myself, but sleepy old Hergershausen might as well be as far from the countercultural vibrancy of Manchester as Margate is from the moon. Anyway, before that, you heard performance poet Annie DeFranco in a live performance recorded back in April, I think. I'm not quite sure where, but anyway, she has an album of her work out now, lots of great stuff on that. And, well, we did vow that for this show we wouldn't have a string of WWWs every minute or so, so just suffice to say that we'll post a link to absolutely everything and everyone featured in the show on our website. Later in the show, Sebastian will be bringing us his roundup of news and stuff from Indie Media. Hi, Sebastian.
Hello.
Yeah, he's been a bit quiet, but with me rabbiting on, that's not surprising. And later on still, we hope to be joined by a couple of Israeli conscientious objectors who have refused to perform their compulsory military service. Well, naturally, that's what conscientious objectors do. We had intended to pre-record the interview yesterday, as we've had all kinds of technical jinxes here with our Skype and whatnot, so we erred on the safe side, but unfortunately we didn't get their phone numbers in time for the interview, a regrettable oversight. Anyway, hopefully they'll be able to join us live during the show, we'll see. And that, of course, brings us to the point that we had intended to record the show as a live Skype cast, but we found that the quality of Skype casting really wasn't up to scratch. Some callers come in loud and clear, but others are all broken up and with those irritating delays on the line and so on. It probably depends on bandwidth, DSL speed and all that other techno geek stuff. Anyway, we spoke to a couple of other Skype casters and they've had the same problems. It's a great idea, but it needs a lot more development, I think. Anyway, maybe sometime in the not too distant future we'll give it another go. It'll probably improve. Anyway, we've been trawling indie media during the past few weeks, and we've come up with some pretty interesting stuff that we'll be featuring in the show, and, well, we might as well start off with this.
Welcome to War of the Trees on WSQT Guerrilla Radio. This week we begin with a special coverage of the 5th anniversary of September 11th. What does September 11th have to do with the war for our Earth? Simple. In summer 2001, the FBI was so busy chasing elves of the Earth Liberation Front that they couldn't be bothered with an investigation that would have preempted the destruction of the Twin Towers on September 11th. In summer 2001, the owner of a flight school approached an FBI agent and asked, "Can you tell me why I've got 14 Saudis in my class, all of whom want to learn on jets and not start on propeller planes like everybody else, none of whom want to learn how to take off, and none of whom want to learn how to land?" The FBI agent said, "I'll get back to you." He went to his boss and said, "You're not going to believe what I've uncovered." And his boss said, "Forget about it. Forget about the flight school. Go out and catch me the Earth Liberation Front." This was because in that operational area, there had been a series of property damage fires, none of which had inflicted a single injury on anyone. Because of this unhealthy obsession with catching the Earth Liberation Front, almost 3,000 people died in the collapse of the towers. The Earth Liberation Front has never flown a jetliner full of civilians into a skyscraper packed with tens of thousands of people. But on September 11th, 2001, someone did exactly that. Someone that the FBI had been told to ignore and concentrate on the Earth Liberation Front instead. This is because all 14 of those pilots that the FBI was told to ignore turned out to be 14 out of the 19 hijackers on September 11th. That's right. If the FBI hadn't been too busy chasing elves, Bin Laden or whoever did September 11th would have had to try and pull it off with 5 guys instead of 19. Probably the entire operation would have been canceled. Instead, thanks to George Bush, John Ashcroft, and his Department of Injustice, and the people George Bush put in the FBI, 3,000 people died in the collapse of the Twin Towers. Not to mention more at the Pentagon, and hundreds just in those airplanes. Airline passengers shouldn't have to rise up and ram the cockpit door with a flight attendant's cart because some bonehead in the FBI was so busy chasing elves that he couldn't be bothered with investigating airplane hijackers. What on earth was going through George Bush's head? Was he reading verses from My Pet Goat like it was the Koran? Or maybe, just maybe, he was thinking it was only going to be airline hijackings, no one was going to get killed, or at worst, the people in the planes were going to die. Maybe, just maybe, some of these Bush people were thinking a couple of hijacked jets would be good for George Bush's presidency. And if that's so, who's the real terrorist here? And while we're on the subject of September 11th, let's not forget the other 9/11, Hurricane Katrina. When Hurricane Katrina howled out of the Gulf of Mexico, it killed nearly as many people in New Orleans as died in the Twin Towers. It did hundreds of times as much property damage. Just as they have still not built anything on the former site of the Twin Towers, rebuilding of New Orleans seems to have ground to a halt. And just as George Bush has done stupid things that make another September 11th more likely instead of less, George Bush has done absolutely nothing about the global warming that turned Katrina from a Bush League hurricane into a Category 5 monster. And I'll tell you another thing. After Hurricane Katrina, President Bush, unlike a real president that was actually elected, did not travel to New Orleans, stand upon a rooftop surrounded by the reeking waters of Hurricane Katrina, and swear vengeance. George Bush did not stand in the wreckage of the hurricane and swear to hunt down the coal and oil industry barons responsible for global warming and smoke them out of their caves. George Bush did not respond to Hurricane Katrina by sending the U.S. Special Forces, the U.S. Air Force, the U.S. Marines, and Predator drones to blow the people responsible for global warming out of their caves. No, the coal and oil industry barons are quite safe in their urban high-rises, knowing that George Bush will never call them to account, just as the 14 hijackers were not investigated while they were in flight school after an FBI agent found out about them. It's probably a good thing, though, that George Bush doesn't treat Hurricane Katrina the way he treated 9/11, because what he's done about Hurricane Katrina makes global warming neither more nor less likely. It does nothing. The response of September 11th has included supporting Israel's attack on Lebanon, has included the brutal war against the people of Iraq, and other things that instead of reducing the supply of one of the airline hijackers and suicide bombers, increase that supply. Thanks to George Bush, the next 9/11 is more likely, not less likely. The next Hurricane Katrina is exactly as likely as before. Neither constitutes an acceptable performance. But then again, as we know, George Bush was never really elected president. He stole the election. So this kind of performance is to be expected.
We started in Provincetown, celebrating WOMR Outermost Radio. And on Saturday, we went to Nantucket. Nantucket is an historic place. It's where Frederick Douglass gave one of his first abolition addresses. He trembled when he spoke, his body shook. His power was in speaking from his own experience. He had been enslaved as a child and a teen. He was born on the eastern shore of Maryland. As a teenager, he'd been given to what was known as a slave breaker, Edward Covey. Other slave owners gave over their troublesome slaves to him, his property there on the eastern shore called Mount Misery. And he almost broke Frederick Douglass. Ultimately, though, Frederick Douglass escaped north, and he changed the world. Mount Misery, Edward Covey's place that knew so much pain, is now owned by the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld. He bought it in 2003 to be near his, well, a quarter of a mile down the road from his close friend, Vice President Dick Cheney. That's what I was thinking about in Nantucket. The night before Provincetown, where we started. And we were speaking at Provincetown High School, so we drove up. It was just about dusk, sun going down, and there was a pickup truck right outside the high school. And I was walking up the steps, and a couple stopped me who'd driven up the pickup truck. And there I saw in the truck bed a coffin. The couple was Carlos and Melita Arredondo. And as I walked up, they quickly told their story. They said they had moved to Florida in the summer of 2004. Carlos was home on his 46th birthday with his mother. Melita was out. And a Marine van pulled up. He thought maybe it was his son Alex surprising him home from Iraq. But it was the Marines. They got out and they told Carlos that his son Alex was dead. He died in the ancient Iraqi city of Najaf at the age of 20 years, 20 days. And Carlos lost his mind. He went into a frenzy. He begged the Marines to leave. They didn't. He begged them again. They didn't. He raced to the garage. He got out some cans of gas. He got one of these blow torches. He asked them to leave again. They didn't. And he went to the van and he started to try to wreck it. And he threw gasoline in the van and he got it over himself. And his mother came out and was trying to pull him out of the van, which triggered the torch and the whole thing blew up. And he was blown out onto the lawn burning, at which point his wife, Melita, pulled up and found her husband burning on the lawn and learned that her stepson, Alex, was dead. And then their son, Brian, their younger son, called. He was on vacation in Maine. He's 17 years old. He was calling his dad to wish him a happy birthday. And someone had turned on the cell phone when they heard the ring, and he heard this massive commotion, and he heard there was press, and someone had turned on the TV where he was in Maine, and he saw his father burning on the lawn. And that's where he learned that his older brother, who he loved and emulated and wanted to be, was dead. One story. No judgment. One story in this time of war. It took Carlos a long time to heal. He was burned on over a quarter of his body, but the physical wasn't the problem. It was emotional. A year later, in August of 2005, Cindy Sheehan went to Crawford, and Carlos Arredondo found his voice. Cindy Sheehan, on August 5th, 2005, she addressed the Dallas Veterans for Peace Convention. It was pretty spontaneous, what she said. She said since she knew she couldn't enjoy another vacation, her son Casey died in Sadr City, 40404, April 4th, 2004, she says. She said she would go to Crawford, where the president was starting one of the longest vacations in presidential history, and she wanted to go to ask for an hour of his time. She wanted him to answer the question, for what noble cause did my son die? She said since she was in Texas, she'd go the next morning. She didn't know where Crawford was, but she figured it's Texas. How far could it be? They started out in a little caravan, and they made their way to the presidential estate. We won't call it a ranch, because it isn't. And she took up residence in a ditch right outside the property. And she just kept asking that question. For what noble cause did my son die? Now, the White House press corps is, well, embedded. Whether in the front lines of the troops in Iraq or in the White House, it comes to the same thing in all too many cases. But beware of even that captured press corps in the heat of a Texas summer, 110-degree weather, when they weren't enjoying the access of evil. That's trading truth for access, because the president was on vacation. And here was this persistent, relentless woman right down the road for them who wouldn't stop asking that question. And finally, they put it to the president. And this shows the power of the press when they ask a question that so many outside who don't enjoy that access are asking. And they asked him why he wouldn't give an hour to spend with this mourning mother. And he responded, "I have to get on with my life too." The Atlanta Journal-Constitution wrote that day that he had gone on a mountain bike ride for 2 hours, fished, gone to a Little League luncheon, napped, and apparently did some reading. And Cindy wouldn't give up. The press asked her, "You're so eloquent. You're so articulate. Why haven't you spoken out before?" And she said, "I have been. You just haven't been listening." If you are a regular viewer, watcher, reader of Democracy Now!, you know about Cindy Sheehan before Crawford. On Inauguration Day 2005, it was a wet, nasty, cold Washington, D.C. set of days. Cindy Sheehan had already been on the move. She and Celeste Zapala — Celeste lost her son Sherwood Baker, the first Pennsylvania National Guardsman to die since World War II. They had tried to ask Donald Rumsfeld if they could meet with him. They didn't get a response, and so they decided they would try to go to the Pentagon right around Inauguration Day on the eve. And they and some others made a little pilgrimage. And when they made it to the Pentagon parking lot, where they met by an envoy of the secretary saying, "He's not available, but if you have a message, I'll pass it on." Or, "My goodness," invited in for a little hot cider and comfort for these grieving women. No, they were met by the black-clad security outside the Pentagon, who turned them back at gunpoint. Beware of mothers who have nothing left to lose. And so Cindy soon made her way to Crawford, and she became a magnet for so many. Like Carlos, it was then that he decided he would drag a coffin around the country to remind people what was happening, not only about his own son, Alex. He's been traveling, sometimes a miniature coffin, sometimes a larger one in Provincetown. You should have seen him coming down the street with that coffin. It was the last big bash, vacation weekend, Labor Day. But he said, "War does not go on vacation," and so neither would he. And then there were the mothers, like Patricia Roberts. Her son Jamal Addison died in Iraq. He was the first Georgia National Guardsman to die there since World War II, and she set up a fund, the Jamal Addison Fund, because she feels that young African-American kids should have a way to go to college without detouring through Iraq. And then there was Nadja McCaffrey. She lost her son, Patrick. She comes from just outside Sacramento. And Patrick joined up after 9/11. He felt he had the perfect life, wife, two kids, and he wanted to give back to his country, protect it in whatever way he could, in time of attack or in time of natural catastrophe. And then he was called up to go to Iraq, and he didn't understand the connection. He didn't know how that would further this country's security. He didn't know what Iraq had to do with 9/11. Well, I come from New York, and my governor is George Pataki. And he went to visit Iraq, and he came back. And he said that he wants to lay a piece of the statue of Saddam Hussein from Fierdos Square, the one that was pulled down by the Marines that we saw thousands of times. The Marines were just out of the frame. He said he wants to take a piece of that statue and embed it in the foundation of a new World Trade Center. If he does that, that will be the first proven link between 9/11 and Iraq. So, Patrick headed to Iraq. He wrote home to send deflated soccer balls and candy for the kids, and he was killed there. And when his casket was brought home, Najib McCaffrey invited all of the press at Sacramento International Airport. Now, President Bush invoked that executive order that says you can't film, videotape, photograph the flag-draped coffins of soldiers coming home or the body bags. Even the soldiers who were critically wounded, there are tens of thousands, are brought home under cover of night. But she said no. She invited the videographers, the photographers, the filmmakers to film, photograph, videotape her son's casket. She said he didn't go to Iraq in darkness, and she didn't want him coming back in darkness. Each of these mothers had engaged in their own defiant act before they made their way to cross. Carlos and Melita Arredondo. They showed me all these documents they kept in all these loose-leaf binders. And one of them was a letter to their son. They said that he's being aggressively recruited by the National Guard, and they don't want him to go. He was 17 when his brother Alex died. He's now 19. The letter began, "Dear American." Now, that's interesting because Carlos is from Costa Rica. He has been applying for citizenship here year after year, but has not gotten it. Even giving the greatest sacrifice an American could, more than his own death, the death of his son. But that has not merited him citizenship in this country. So the letter goes on, "Dear American," it's to Brian, and it talks about serving your country, especially in times like Katrina. Now that's very interesting, given that as this American city drowned, and more than 1,500 people died. A number of them could have been saved, but the troops were in Iraq. The president on one of the longest vacations in history altogether, he has been vacationing for more than a year of his time in office. But did he, after being briefed fully about the horror of this imminent, not hurricane that did hit, but the hurricane that was coming, did he race to New Orleans? Did he come out of that vacation? No, he did leave Crawford, but he went to California. And he had his picture taken, these pictures he allowed, strumming the guitar of the country music singer Mark Wills. His signature song, "Wish You Were Here," could have been the theme song of the people of New Orleans. It wasn't only President Bush that didn't respond. His Vice President Cheney was in Wyoming fly fishing, vacationing Monday. You know, the hurricane hit Tuesday, the levees broke Wednesday. They're all still on vacation. Condoleezza Rice, Secretary of State, was in New York doing some high-end shoe shopping at Ferragamo. A customer yelled, "What are you doing shopping when people in New Orleans are drowning?" And they took her out. The customer, that is. She took in a Broadway play, Spamalot. She played tennis with Monica Seles. We're talking well past the breach of the levees in the hurricane. And then there was Andrew Card. He was the chief of staff, former GM lobbyist, vacationing in New England, former GM lobbyist. Yes, what we've seen in Washington is the ascendancy of the oiligarchy. You've got President Bush, a failed oil man, Vice President Dick Cheney, former head of the largest oil services corporation in the world, Halliburton. Condoleezza Rice served on the board of Chevron for more than 10 years, even had a Chevron oil tanker named after her, the Condoleezza Rice. Andrew Carr, the GM lobbyist, and more. Is it any surprise they're hungry for oil? Like the joke of the kid saying to his father, "What's our oil doing under their sand?" Might explain something of U.S. relations with Iraq to Venezuela. But a side effect of them not responding is when the corporate media did the right thing, they just went down to New Orleans. There were no troops to embed with. And we saw, perhaps for one of the first times, corporate media reporting from the victim's perspective. And it was astounding. We saw the bodies floating by on our TV screens. The Bush administration leaped into action. They tried to, again, say, "You are not to film the bodies." And the editor of the Times-Picayune said, "You've got to be kidding." And then, from the bodies floating by to a young woman reporter, a man walked up out of the water with his boy holding his hand. He said he was in the attic. And as his wife's hand slipped away from him, she said, "Take care of the children." And this is a story the man told the reporter, and in shock, he just waded off into the water with his boy. And the reporter started to cry. This is reporting from the victim's perspective, ground zero reporting. And the effect across this country, it didn't matter if you were conservative Republican or a progressive or a Democrat or an independent, politics had nothing to do with it. People were horrified. How could this happen to an American city in the 21st century? Could you imagine if we saw these same images in Iraq day after day for just 1 week? Babies dead on the ground, women with their legs blown off from cluster bombs, soldiers dead and dying for just 1 week. I really do think that Americans are a compassionate people, and they would say, no, war is not an answer to conflict in the 21st century. I wanted to just talk about a story we did a few weeks ago about Raed Jarar. Some of you might have seen it or heard it or read it. He's the Iraqi blogger. He does raedinthemiddle.blogspot.com, his analysis of his home in Iraq, what's going on, the politics, the war, what's happening. But he's come to this country. He's got a green card, and he was living in San Francisco. And he was taking a plane from Kennedy Airport to San Francisco. And he was about to get on until four security officials from JetBlue and TSA said that he wouldn't be allowed on the plane with his T-shirt that he was wearing. His T-shirt was black, and it had white letters, and it said, "We will not be silent." And he said, "What's wrong with my T-shirt?" And they said, "It's threatening." And he said, "But it just says, 'We will not be silent.'" And they said, "It's not the English. It's the Arabic script above it." And he said, "Oh, well, that's just Arabic for 'we will not be silent.'" And they said, "Well, we can't know that because we don't have a translator." They said to him that wearing a T-shirt with Arabic script on an American plane today is like walking into a bank with a T-shirt that says, "I am a robber." He asked if Arabic is now a terrorist language, and he tried to fight back to say it's his constitutional right. He's now a taxpayer. He should be able to go on this plane, but it didn't look like it was going to happen. And the JetBlue official, he said, went, and the TSA told us this, got a T-shirt. I think they bought it. It might have said New York on it. And they said, "If you don't put this, cover your T-shirt with this, you're not getting on the plane." He thought it was an important issue, not one to be deported for or to go to Guantanamo for. And so he put on the T-shirt, and they escorted him on the plane first. He had reserved a seat in the front where he likes to sit, but they brought him to the back of the bus, I mean plane. And then the rest of the passengers were allowed to board, and he flew to San Francisco. We told the story in the next few days with Ra'ed. And the next day, some women came into our studio. We work out of a 100-year-old firehouse in downtown Manhattan, just a few blocks from Ground Zero. And they walked in, and they were all wearing these T-shirts. And I started to ask them what they were doing, and they said they had to leave. They were racing to the airport. And I said, "Well, where are you going?" They said, "It doesn't matter. We're getting on planes." It reminded me of another T-shirt story, one that David and I wrote about in our first book, Exception to the Rulers. The Downs. That's Roger and Stephen Downs, father and son, outside a mall in Albany, New York, did the patriotic thing. They went shopping. It was right before the invasion, and they both bought T-shirts. And the father, Stephen Downs' T-shirt, said something very radical. I think it was peace on earth. And his son, Roger, got one that was more specific. It said, "No war with Iraq and let the inspections work." And then they went, they put on their T-shirts, and they went to the food court to get something to eat. And a security guard came up to them and said if they didn't take off the T-shirts, they would be arrested. There was no protesting allowed in the mall. Stephen Downs, the father, said he wasn't going to take off the T-shirt, and they handcuffed him and arrested him. He was very surprised, this retired attorney with the State Commission on Judicial Misconduct. 3 days later, 150 people wearing T-shirts descended on the mall. Security locked themselves in their offices. And the charges against Attorney Downs were dropped. But these stories are instructive. We have to stand together. I don't mean we have to agree with each other. But we have to stand together to make it more difficult to target any individual or any population. Here in this country, the most targeted are Arab Americans, Muslims, and we have to stand together to make it more difficult for individuals to be isolated. You know the saying from World War II, Pastor Martin Niemöller, "First they came for the socialist, I wasn't a socialist, so I didn't speak out. Then they came for the trade unionists, I wasn't a trade unionist, so I didn't speak out. Then they came for the Jews and the Catholics, I was neither, so I didn't speak out. And then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak out." I was invited on MSNBC to talk about Ra'ed's story. And the host of the show said to me, "But, I mean, in this day and age, we may not like racial profiling, but isn't it necessary?" And I said, actually, no, if you're talking about the security of this country. In fact, it's very harmful. How will we catch the next Timothy McVeigh? And remember what happened after he blew up the Oklahoma City building. I mean, it was pretty clear there were others who had worked with him. Did anyone suggest that all blonde-haired, blue-eyed, white Christian men should be rounded up in this country? Of course not.
Yeah, that was Amy Goodman, who is truly an amazing journalist, as is her brother David Goodman. The two of them having co-authored the two brilliant books, The Exception to the Rulers and Static, Government Liars and Media Cheerleaders. Amy Goodman fronts the groundbreaking Democracy Now! Public radio broadcast and podcast. We referred to it in our last show. And she and the Democracy Now! Team have just completed a mega tour around the US, visiting something like 70 US cities, some amazing number anyway. And that was recorded en route. Amy has attracted huge and, in my view, well justified praise, such as, quote, Amy Goodman has taken investigative journalism to new heights, and that's from Noam Chomsky, no less. And what journalism should be, beholden to the interest of people, not power and profit. And that's from Arundhati Roy. And at times when people are told to watch what they say, Amy Goodman is not afraid to speak truth to power. She does it every day. And that's from Susan Sarandon. And another one, pick up this book, shake your head in disbelief and disgust as you read it, and then go and raise some hell. And that's from Michael Moore. So she certainly has some a great deal of respect for her amazing, amazing journalism. Of course, some people take exception to it, and we've got, we have this quote, for example, hostile, combative, and even disrespectful. Well, how awful. And that is from President Bill Clinton, can you imagine? And a threat to national security, and that's from the Indonesian military. Well, that just about says it all. And I have advised my mother to talk to no reporters because of people like you. And that's from former House Speaker Newt Gingrich. Well, yeah, what can you say? That's enough of that. It's time now to move on with Sebastian's roundup of news and other stuff from Indie Media. Sebastian.
Thanks a lot. We'll start with this. One of the most distressing reports to come out of Indie Media this week was the murder of prominent Indie Media journalist and activist Brad Will in the Mexican city of Oaxaca. Brad had been in the city for 4 weeks covering the popular uprising against the city government. The uprising began as a strike by local teachers, but grew into a massive revolt by the city's populace which, though largely peaceful, has drawn an especially brutal response from the city authorities. Brad's video camera continued to record after he had been shot in the chest. Five individuals believed to have been his assailants were also captured on video by Brad's camera. These have been identified as two members of the local city hall, two police officers, and a former justice of the peace of a nearby town. The city authorities initially claimed that the five men had been arrested and taken into custody, but it has since been revealed that this claim is entirely false and that the whereabouts of the five men is currently unknown. As well as his remarkable journalism, Brad Will has also been prominent in the New York City's grassroots activist community and was instrumental in setting up the pioneering micro-radio project, Steal This Radio.
I think for the FCC, micromedia that is non-commercial, anti-profit, community-based is poison to their program of supporting corporate control of the media. And what they are interested in is supporting the National Association of Broadcasting and their complete leveling of culture in the United States, their complete clear-cutting of American tastes and values, and trying to propagate through Congress, through elected officials, through lobbyists, through huge amounts of money being thrown into the media spectrum, their ability to control what people think.
Brad was also a committed member of the Newark Squatters movement and famously stood on the rooftop of one famous squat that housed a cafe, meeting space and performing arts area to prevent its demolition by city bulldozers.
We were making a home out of a crumbling building. You know, the interior of the building needed help, and we brought that building back to life. It was standing strong. And the only reason it was standing was because people were living in it. If we had let it go the way the city wanted it to go, they tore out the stairwell. They punched holes in the roof. The water, the rain was rotting that building from the inside out. We replaced the joists. We rebuilt the floors. We sheetrocked the walls and made that building alive. What did they do? They killed it. That building's over 100 years old. It was standing strong.
Brad was just 36 years of age and had spent most of his adult life campaigning for direct democracy and alternative economic structures, in addition to his courageous journalism for indie media. In other news, the U.S. National Labor Committee has issued a report claiming that some 200 children, some 11 years old or younger, are sewing clothes for Walmart, Hanes, JCPenney, and Puma at the Harvest Ridge factory in Bangladesh. These children are reportedly compelled to work shifts sometimes as long as 19 to 20 hours and are routinely slapped or beaten for falling behind in their work or for taking too long in the single, wretchedly filthy toilet that lacks toilet paper, soap or towels. In the month of September, the report reveals the children had just one day off and when shipments were due to leave for the U.S., were obliged to work 95 to 110 hours a week, often sleeping for just 3 hours a night on the factory floor. The report goes on to denounce voluntary corporate monitoring, pointing out that the clothing industry's own worldwide responsible apparel production, or RAP monitoring group, has certified the Harvest Ridge factory. The report states, not only did U.S. companies fail to notice the child workers, the beatings, the excessive mandatory overtime, but also that not one single worker in Harvest Ridge was paid the correct overtime pay. Any worker daring to ask their proper wages or that their most basic rights be respected would immediately be attacked, beaten and fired. Currently, some 100 children are being threatened with dismissal. The children earn just 6.5 US cents an hour. Workers interviewed claimed that were they to be paid just 36 cents per hour, they could haul themselves out of poverty and live with a modicum of decency. The UK's Guardian newspaper has revealed that the CIA tried to persuade Germany to pressure the EU to silence criticism of the human rights record of Morocco, a key ally in the US clandestine torture flights program. According to a secret intelligence report, the CIA offered Germany access to one of its citizens who had been rendered to Morocco on the condition that Berlin should, quote, avert pressure from the EU regarding Morocco's human rights record. The classified documents prepared for the German Bundestag last February revealed that Germany eventually did get access to the detainee in Morocco and that the detainee was then flown to Syria in another rendition flight. Syria offered access to the prisoner on the condition that Germany dropped charges against Syrian intelligence agents accused of threatening Syrian dissidents. Germany subsequently dropped the charges. The Guardian notes that since the deal was offered to Germany, EU countries have, quote, adopted an almost universal policy of downplaying criticism of human rights records in countries where terrorist suspects have been held. They have also sidestepped questions about secret CIA flights, partly because of grown evidence of their complicity. A British humanist organization, the Manifesto Club, has issued a damning report condemning the increased use of vetting by employers of employees whose work brings them into contact with children, usually in compliance with legislation requiring them to do so. Vetting involves a check with the Criminal Records Bureau as to whether a prospective employee has a criminal record that may present a risk to minors. However, not only are paid employees affected, but also volunteers to community events, charities, and so forth. Report reveals that those routinely vetted now include 16-year-olds who teach younger kids to read, hospital secretaries who rarely meet children, foster carers' friends, parent volunteers in school, cricket umpires, private music teachers, students who help out on college open days, plumbers who check school plumbing, grandmothers who carry out voluntary work in schools, and child psychologists. Running an after-school club is now subject to more stringent tests than selling explosives or practicing law, the report points out. The financial burden involved has brought about a dearth of volunteers for schools, events, and charities, the report claims. Volunteers often have to pay from £7 to £30, roughly €10 to €45, themselves for a check, while employers pay from £30 to £36. The Volunteer Reading Help organization spends £4,300 vetting its 120 staff, and the Scout Association carries out some 50,000 checks a year at a cost of some £250,000, the report reveals. Vetting casts such a wide net that it becomes more difficult to distinguish between trustworthy and untrustworthy adults, the Manifesto Club claims. Vetting teaches children to be suspicious of all adults and bureaucratizes informal relationships. We are concerned about the damaging consequences that adult vetting has for the relation between the generations. That is why we have decided to join with other concerned people to campaign against the policing of adult-child relations. The US military has admitted that it has issued false information to families of 7 US soldiers killed in Iraq and Afghanistan, including the family of former US football star Pat Tillman, who were told that he had died in action. In fact, he had been killed by a fellow Army Ranger in Afghanistan. Similarly, the family of Patrick McCaffrey, whose mother Naja McCaffrey established the organization Families for Peace, were told that Patrick had died in action, whereby he had in fact been shot by an Iraqi soldier being trained by US troops. In a separate issue, the weblog The Black Packet has highlighted the fact that the internet access of US Marines is being monitored and restricted. A US Marine station in Iraq sent a screenshot to the Black Packet of what happens when Marines attempt to access radical or left-leaning websites such as Wonkat and Talking Points Memo, which read, "Forbidden. This page, www.wonkat.com, is categorized as personal pages." And then, in capital letters, "All sites you visit are locked and filed." The corporal commented, "I can understand blocking porn, music and movies, and blatantly illegal sites. But blocking sites that some higher-up just doesn't agree with is disgusting. They are blocking a huge portion of voters from information that will help them determine which site to vote for. Because of this, the only news we get is from big corporations or conservative sites." And finally, as you heard earlier in Amy Goodman's address, in the post-9/11 world of Bush's and Blair's war on terror, wearing a t-shirt with a seemingly innocuous slogan, "We will not be silent," places you under suspicion of being a terrorist. Since the infamous JetBlue incident described by Amy, other t-shirt incidents have occurred. Stephanie Schwartz is a US student who was accosted by security staff on New York's Staten Island ferry while wearing the same t-shirt.
2 weeks ago, I got on the Staten Island ferry. It was Monday morning, and I was wearing this t-shirt. It says, "We will not be silent," both in Arabic and then in English. As soon as my friends and I sat down on the ferry, four armed Coast Guard officers came and, you know, positioned themselves around us. And I kind of joked to my friends, like, "Do you think it's because of my t-shirt?" But I didn't really believe that that they would have made such a big deal about it. And we sat there for the half-hour ferry ride, and they didn't move. And as I was getting off the boat, I was stopped by a security guard who said, excuse me, Miss B, you better not wear that shirt on the ferry again. And I was kind of taken aback. Excuse me, what are you talking about? And he said, well, I don't think it's safe. This is a high-security area. I asked him, well, what's unsafe about this shirt? What do you think it means? And he didn't actually comment on what the shirt meant. He just asked me, isn't it in Arabic? And I said, well, just kind of looked at him incredulously. I couldn't believe he was actually saying that. And he said, well, you remember, what happened on that JetBlue flight? And I said, yeah, I remember that incident. I think it was racial profiling because they didn't allow him to wear the shirt on the plane simply because it was in Arabic. And they said they didn't have a translator to tell them what it meant. And he said, well, obviously you're not a threat to us, but someone else wearing that shirt might be. And, I asked him if he meant by that, an Arab wearing a shirt with Arabic script on it would be considered a terrorist. And he didn't answer the question. He just told me again that I better not wear this shirt on the ferry.
In another incident, a 13-year-old boy won his legal case against a school for preventing him from wearing a T-shirt bearing a slogan critical of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. And 14-year-old Julie Wilson was pulled from her biology class and interrogated by FBI agents for 15 minutes after she had placed a cartoon on her MySpace site showing a picture of George Bush emblazoned with the word Kill Bush. The cartoon has already been removed on the advice of her school when the interrogation, which was not conducted in the presence of her parents, took place.
Okay, thanks for that, Sebastian. There's a bit of a hum off your mic. We'll have to try and do something about that. Anyway, I don't know if wearing a Vox Populi T-shirt would mark you out as a potential terrorist, but they will be available for purchase shortly, so do keep your eye on our website. They are the fashion accessory that you just cannot do without. Now, I forgot to mention earlier, during Amy Goodman's piece, we played a track by Anti-Flag that was called I'd Tell You But I'm Dead. Anti-Flag are pretty well known in the US on the radical independent music scene, although they've just signed up to a major label. I'm not sure if that's a good or a bad thing. Anyway, I missed their last tour of Europe, but the next time they're over here, I'll make a point of seeing them and maybe getting an interview with them for Vox Pop. That would be nice. Anyway, let's move on now with another interesting item that we found posted up on Indie Media during the recent post 9/11 hoo-ha.
Mabuhay, and welcome to Radio Intelligent Aboriginal. It seems that race is all over the American media. No one seems to know what to do about it, but the Bush administration, it seems, just continues to embrace it. If you've read Raw's story this morning, you realize that a new book, The Architect, Karl Rove and the Master Plan for Absolute Power, quotes George Bush telling journalist Ken Herman, "You know what I'm going to do with those Jews when I get to Israel, don't you, Herman? I'm telling them they're all going to hell." It was a really stupid thing to say, especially since the Reverend Jesse Jackson is still paying for his Hymietown remark, even though he's apologized for it a million times over. But there's still one that tops that even more so. You can check out Voice of a Native Son, the blog of this podcast, at angryindian.blogspot.com. And you notice in today's post, Hypocrisy in Action, example number 7, that Condoleezza Rice, the most powerful African in the American government, is also concerned about race. And I, the angry Indian, am so glad that after all of this time, Condoleezza Rice has taken a little bit of her position to bring up slavery, the legacy of African slavery. And like the Voice of a Native Son blog and Radio Intelligent Aboriginal, she points out that the legacy of African slavery in the United States can be related to pieces of American policy overseas. How does she do it? Well, the number one Uncle Thomasina in the Bush government has gone one further than Bush or Senator Allen or any of these other morons that you can pick out that have been in and out of the news all week saying stupid things, especially in terms of race. She went one further by suggesting that opponents of the Iraq War are the moral equivalents of those who would tolerate slavery
in the 19th century. Now, this is kind of strange because we have Donald Rumsfeld and Rove and Cheney compare all of us who are opposed to, let's just call it what it is, colonialism in the 21st century in the Middle East by the United States. He equated us to the Vichy government in France. But, hey, you know, I mean, they can make all the comparisons they want. None of them make any sense except to the supporters of these guys. But this one, for people of color, they really need to pay attention to this. Because after everything else that's been happening in the United States, her and her predecessor, General Powell, haven't said anything. And the one time she does bring up racism in the United States and the legacy of racism in the United States, she compares it to Iraq. But dig, listen to how she does it. This is what she tells Essence magazine. I'm sure there are people who thought it was a mistake to fight the Civil War to its end and to insist that the emancipation of slaves would hold. I know there were people who said, why don't we get out of this now and take a peace with the South, but leave the South with slaves? Well, Condi, if you're happening to listen to this or one of your lackeys, you might want to take note that President Lincoln made it very clear in his Emancipation Proclamation speech that this was not an olive branch to blacks, that if he could maintain the South and maintain slavery, he would. A lot of historians, you know, especially when they're teaching our kids, they tend to gloss over the fact, or should I say, just flat out ignore the fact, selectively ignore the fact, however you want to put it, that he wanted to send African people back to Africa. The only problem was nobody wanted to pay for the ships. And, you know, there wasn't a budget there that he could just up and do what he wanted to with the money to do what he wanted. So he sent some to Guyana. They always forget that. He was just as much a bigot as everybody in this administration, regardless of their color on the outside. You know, it's just not a matter of Oreos. It's a matter of Oreos, bananas, and apples, no matter how you look at it. If you're of color and you support this administration, and if you think that Condoleezza Rice says something profound, I think you need to take a stark, hard look in the mirror and then pick up a history book and then ask yourself if what she said wasn't one of the biggest insults to African people in this country that you have ever heard. And that's a wrap for this edition of Radio Intelligent Aboriginal News. As always, thank you for joining us. From Occupied North America, this is the Angry Indian for Radio Intelligent Aboriginal. Sigit.
Okay, that was The Angry Indian. You can find his blog, Radio Intelligent Aboriginal, regularly on www.radio.indymedia.org. There I go again. I promise not to do all those wobblies. Anyway, he always has some pretty acerbic stuff on ugly US politics, Bush bullshit and corporate machinations, particularly where they have a bearing on racial issues. Well, now I'm happy to say that we have managed to reach one of the conscientious objectors we were going to talk to. Yael Dreyer is an Israeli conscientious objector. We couldn't reach Leo, the other one. However, Rafe Birney, who is a journalist living in Turkey, he has written a lot of stuff about human rights and ethnic issues there. He has very kindly offered to step in at the last moment, for which we are very grateful. Starting with you, Yael, perhaps you could start by giving us a bit of background to conscientious objection in Israel. Presumably you become eligible for compulsory military service at age 18, is that right?
Yes, they consider you as you're supposed to be, they know that you're supposed to serve, so they put you kind of like a soldier since you're 17, which means when you come and you say, I refuse to serve, they don't judge you and imprison you for refusing to serve. They judge you for refusing an order.
I see. So there is, it is possible then to refuse military service. You can say in Israel that, yeah, I refuse to do military service, and what, do they not put you in prison then? But
They do. They put you in prison, but for refusing an order, because they see it as that I refuse to, you know, get on the bus to go to the base or to take this to take the things you want and to sign a paper. So you refuse an order. But they judge you for refusing an order and you're in prison for it. You do get in prison for refusing.
So what if you say to the military, I'm a conscientious objector and I refuse to do my military service on moral grounds? Is there any way that they will accept that?
Well, they do release pacifists, but their definition of a pacifist is someone who's really extreme, you know, wouldn't use violence in any kind of way, form, no matter what. And of course, if you say that you refuse because of the occupation, they will not feel as a, they won't see it as a conscious reason. They will see it as a political reason. And then they will say you are not a conscious objector. And you're refusing for political reasons. I mean, they differentiate, conscious and political reasons, which I think is ridiculous.
I see. And, are they set certain criteria for recognizing you as conscious objector? If you say that I'm a pacifist,
yeah.
They will they accept that? They will accept that I'm a pacifist.
Yeah, it would be hard to get their approval of it, but they will. But you know, I was in front of the conscious objector community, like the community that say you're a conscious objector or not. And I told them that I cannot be in the army because what the army does, and because I think it's morally wrong, because of the expectation, because the way it treats women and the problem is it makes in our society, and that I cannot take part in it. And they said that, you know, that means I'm not a conscious objector, that I'm a political objector.
I see. So even though you said that you refused to join the Israeli military because you don't believe in the military and you don't believe in what it's doing to your society,
mm-hmm.
They just said, well, that's a political position, and they refused to accept that.
Exactly.
I see.
So they refused to release me, and I would have to object and go to prison.
I see. And how long would you have to go to prison for?
Well, that's a difficult question. Thing is, you get, as I said, you're being judged for refusing an order. And you can be judged between 2 weeks and a month, depends on what the judge decides. It's not that, there's no exact clause of how long. But after you get to this, you're still considered a soldier and you will be still asked to be backed, and you say, I refuse to do that. Then you refuse an order again, and then you get in prison again because you perform the felony again.
So you can be repeatedly penalized for not joining the military.
Exactly.
It's not something. Okay, and you said that you refused to join the military because of what it was doing to your society. Perhaps you can expand on that. What exactly is the military doing to Israeli society?
I think it turns it into a more violent society, a less acceptance of not judgmental about people in power. It's really easy to control her and accept that. If you see, like, a lot of problems with violence, especially violence against women, inside the family and outside the family, the problem of racism and like, jumping into solving conflict with power, not with conversation, and see it as, like, there's a violent and chauvinist thing inside the society. It's so important within the society. That will have an impact on the society. There's no way. And the army in Israel is considered, like, the army of the people, and you know, it means people are an army, and I don't think that's a good thing. I don't think it makes the society better in any way.
Okay, let me turn now to Rafe in Turkey. Rafe, Yael made some interesting points there about the whole issue of conscientious objection in Israel, and I'd like to take up some of the points you made with you. The line to Yael was rather poor, so I don't know if you could make out everything she said. But Turkey is a country in which the military plays a very dominant role in society, as does mass popular nationalism, it must be said. so maybe there's a coming together of issues there. But I'd like to ask you, first of all, is it possible to actually register as a conscientious objector in Turkey?
I don't know the answer to that question, but I suspect that the system doesn't allow for the registration of a conscientious objector. So if you're going to become a conscientious objector, or if you are a conscientious objector, you're actually, in practice, challenging the system. And how you would register that, of course, is refusing to do military service, or to touch a gun, or wear a uniform, or whatever.
Well, that was very interesting, because that Yael was just making exactly the same point, that when I put the same question to her, that yes, you can register yourself as a conscientious objector, but they will only recognise you in theory if you say you're a pacifist. But if you say that you're, well, you know, I refuse to fight in an army that because I don't like armies, and I don't like what the army is doing to our society, then they say, oh, that's political. That's political. You're refusing to join for political reasons. Basically, you're saying that the situation there in Turkey is quite similar to that.
Well, as far as I understand it, you have no justification in the eyes of the state to refuse to serve in the military forces. And a justification saying that I don't believe in violence, or I refuse to be put into a position where I'm ordered to kill other people, would not be accepted as a legitimate excuse.
Mm-hmm. And does anyone know exactly how many conscientious objectors there are in Turkey?
Well, I don't think it's possible to know, except in terms of those who are prosecuted by the state for refusing to do military service. I mean, there's a number that I've seen recorded by the War Resisters International organization, which is a CEO sort of monitors organization, which says that I think there's something like 80 existing, I have a quote in front of me, 80 existing conscientious objectors. I'm not sure whether that's the total in Turkey or whether that's the total of conscientious objectors who are trying to bring their case to the European Court of Human Rights.
Hmm. One of the most...
I suspect there may be more, but in terms of Turkish culture, being a conscientious objector would be seen, I think, by the vast majority of Turks, or certainly a majority, as tantamount to refusing to support the state, or to refusing to support the nation. I think most people would feel that it was tantamount to that, if not exactly that.
Yeah, this is very interesting, because you have this very sort of powerful nationalism here involved. And yeah, Yael was saying that, you know, in Israel too, you have so much popular support for the military. Is that how it plays out in Turkey, do you think?
Yes, I think there's a direct parallel with Turkey. And I think if you consider the coup d'etats in the 60s and the 80s, or 1980, that any sort of falling out of line with what is perceived to be both state nationalist and even now straying into a religious territory, if you step out of line, you're considered to be, in some sense, at least an outlaw, if not an enemy. There is a highly sensitive national self-consciousness of the nation. And of course, Turkey is a very new nation in terms of its appearance on the world stage as a republic. And there's great sensitivity about any sort of criticism of that, or even of the criteria on which it depends. And the press on the whole tends to work to support the identity of Turkish nationalism as almost a sacred cow, that it's treacherous to criticize or to question. So this puts people of a liberal or of an inquiring or even at a fundamentally European democratic mindset into a very difficult position.
Yeah. Yael, turning back to you, Rafe was just saying there about Turkey's image of itself. Israel likes to portray itself as it likes to portray itself defensively. There is this argument that Israel is surrounded on all sides by enemies who will not accept its existence, and so it is constantly obliged to defend itself. Yet, I mean, around the world, it is sort of increasingly being seen as the aggressor and brutally occupying Palestine and attacking Lebanon and so on. And, you know, also there's the treatment of the issue of the treatment of Arab Israelis within Israel and so on. But do you accept any of this argument that Israel has to constantly defend itself?
I think that, you know, when you look at it in the macro, you can see that, you know, there are terrorists, and you can say, okay, so Israel has to defend itself. But Israel has to defend itself from the rage and the anger and the rage and the hatred that she creates herself. And it's a circle. And then you look at one part of the circle, and you can say, oh, Israel is being attacked, but Israel is also attacking, and then they attack her back and she attacks back. And yeah, I mean, Israel is inside a war, therefore it is being attacked, but she can stop the war, and therefore she must. And I don't think there's any argument to the fact that she is occupying Palestinians. That is a fact. You know, I can just go and see it in my own eyes, and I can see the results of her actions. For example, this morning there was a bombing in Gaza Strip, in the Bethlehem, and now they're talking about stopping the sort of a ceasefire. I mean, in a way that there aren't suicide bombers, and now they're talking about having suicide bombers again, having terror attacks inside Israel. And, you know, that scares me a lot. I live in Jerusalem, that injures me, and I'm also very upset and horrified from the slaughter that had just happened this morning. And now it's like to say, oh, we've been attacked, but it's a reaction to the attack this morning, and it's just a circle.
A vicious circle, yeah. Do you think there is any way out of this vicious circle? I mean, now Israel is building this great big wall around itself as though it can wall out its detractors and those who wish to, as it would argue, harm it. Is there any way out of this situation, do you think?
I do believe that there can be peace. And as I said, just today I sat with a Palestinian from East Jerusalem. I live in West Jerusalem. And we sat together and talked, and we talked about the action that we can do together to stop the occupation, to fight against it anyway. And I see that as a great hope. I know that I've been to Palestinian villages, and I've been accepted, and everyone knew I was an Israeli and a Jew, and they accepted me, and I was a part of the struggle, and I was respected, and I was, you know, invited there. And I know that Palestinian and Israelis can live together, but it's out of together as Palestinian citizens of Israel or not citizens of Israel. But to do that, we have to stop hating each other and stop thinking that the other side is a monster, and to really have a conversation and to have a right solution in the political, like having a Palestinian state that is really individual, not like under the control of Israel and the United States, and have, like, stop the occupation and have free, a real free Palestinian state, and then that's the only way I think that we can get outside of Gaza. As long as there are occupation, there will be a circle. Even if Israel will get all our soldiers out, like she did in the Gaza Strip, and all the settlers out, it wouldn't be until the wall will fall and until there will be peace and there will be a Palestinian state.
So you yourself have been very much involved in, like, the peace movement between Israel and Palestinians. And you say that you were well accepted by Palestinians, that they weren't sort of innately aggressive towards you. They accepted you as a person who was genuinely on their side. Would that be
correct? Well, of course there will be always extremists who will hate Israelis and Jews just for being Israelis and Jews, and not saying all Palestinians are prophets, but the majority, the big majority of Palestinians did accept me and did respect me, and I mean, if you're after Africa, aren't you afraid to go to Palestinian villages and walk there, you know, like with a shirt that has Hebrew writing on it and talking in Hebrew to my friends? And I said, no, I'm not afraid. I feel really safe. I'm going to go and speak, and like people in the tower wave hello to me, and everyone is being nice. I mean, it's amazing, and people don't think that's impossible because they're so afraid and they can't believe that it is possible that Palestinians and Jews will work together and struggle together.
And how do you see the relationship between Israel and the U.S.? I mean, people around the world find this very puzzling that, you know, the U.S. seems to support Israel so much, so passionately. And, you know, people who criticize Israeli foreign policy are often, you know, accused of being anti-Semitic and this kind of thing. The U.S. gives so much economic and military support to Israel. Do you see the sort of the role of the U.S. as exacerbating the problem and making it worse and encouraging Israel in, let's call it, its aggression? How do you see the role of the U.S. And the relationship between the U.S. and Israel?
I think the relationship is based on economical profit from both sides. And that is what is important. I don't think the United States sees it like the happened to Israel people or happened to Palestinian people, take as, I mean, I'm talking about the American government, as how to make more profit and how to make the political profit and economical profit out of the situation. And it needs Israel, so it supports Israel, and Israel needs the U.S. So that, I think, is the background to this relationship between them. I do think that the United States, If Bush will come and see that, I don't know, the occupation is bad for America, and he thinks stop, and he will come and he will say stop the occupation, I do believe that it will happen, and I do believe it's in the power of the American government to force the Israeli government to start negotiating peace, and it's also possible for it to start a war, and I think that's part of what happened in the Second Lebanon War. And behind it is American interest. There's a lot of American interest in this area, and I think that they influence a lot of things going on here.
And just getting back to the issue of your personal conscientious objection, how do Israeli citizens regard conscientious objectors? Do they regard you as traitors, as Rafe indicated was the case in Turkey, or do they support you? What is the popular psychology in Israel regarding the military and regarding conscientious objectors?
It depends. I mean, some people think that they should kill us or deport us. I hear, I don't think it's a majority, but I do hear a lot of people say, like, if they don't do military service or citizen service, and they just, you know, continue with their lives, then they shouldn't be here and they should be deported. They should have their citizenship taken. There is a lot of hatred and there is a lot of anger, and it is it's not an easy subject. It enrages a lot of people.
And what is your situation at the moment? Are you actually facing imprisonment, or have you served any time in prison?
No.
What is your situation now?
Right now, my birth date is to the end of January, and that is when I'm going to be first drafted, and that is when I'm going to refuse. Until then, the military consider me as someone who is waiting for the draft date. So, no, I am sitting in front of imprisonment. As far as I know, I don't think they're going to release me. They told me that they don't see me as a conscious objective. So now I'm deflating. I'm expecting to be in prison.
Okay, well, finally, let me turn to Rafe again. Rafe, there is one particular Turkish conscientious objector worth mentioning, Mehmet Tauhan. He is probably Turkey's most well-known conscientious objector. Not only has he been very vocal, very forthright about his conscientious objection, very courageous, actually, he has a pretty well-developed campaign surrounding him, but he is also Kurdish and is also an openly gay man, which is fairly remarkable, I think, in terms of Turkish culture. He seems to have gotten everything wrong in view of perhaps the popular psyche there in Turkey.
Well, that may be so, but I mean, if you're talking about attitudes towards homosexuality in Turkey, yes, of course, traditionally and culturally, it's not accepted. But I mean, it's no secret that, as in any other society, there is a significant number of men who are homosexual, and they find ways to to make the best of their sexuality. I don't think there's any secret in Turkey.
But presumably they never actually come out as Mehmet Tahan has done.
Well, no, I think men in Turkey do come out, but if and there are sort of high profile entertainers and actors, etc., who are well known to be gay, but they they're regular appearers on television and stage, but it would probably be a different matter if they came out and said, if they actually explicitly stated their sexuality. But it's quite clear that they are gay, and society accepts them. They're not seen as any threat. Well, I think they would come out as a threat if they started to challenge Turkish law or even challenge religious convention. I think that then they would be under threat. But if they just practice their lives in sort of moderate way, without seeking publicity specifically for their sexuality, they are. I mean, they're generally accepted.
Okay. Thanks very much for that, Rafe, especially for coming in at the last moment.
Not at all.
And thank you too very much, Yagil, and do keep us up to date with your situation.
Thank you. Good night.
Just another point I'd like to make about Mehmet Tahan. Being gay does actually constitute grounds for disqualification from military service in Turkey, believe it or not. But despite his being openly gay, he has consistently refused to cite it as grounds for not doing military service, and will only accept exemption on grounds of conscience. A very courageous and principled guy. Anyway, now for something different. Harry Belafonte is not only a singer and entertainer, he was also a very prominent figure in the civil rights movement and was a very close friend of Dr. Martin Luther King. He is also a very strong advocate of social justice and is one of the most vociferous critics of George Bush and the Bush regime. He really is right up there with Gore Vidal, Noam Chomsky, Michael Moore. Yeah. And when Loretta Scott King, Dr. King's widow, died earlier this year, he was invited to her funeral and was asked to deliver his personal eulogy. Then George Bush announced that he was going to attend, and Harry Belafonte was suddenly uninvited. The funeral itself was really a total fiasco, a total abuse of the memory of Dr. King and the history of and legacy of the civil rights movement. This piece, which was recorded by Democracy Now!, made me really, really mad. It really did.
When she died, none of us knew that she was in Mexico. I knew that she was ill. I knew about the heart attack, the defibrillation, and the stroke. And I knew she had cancer, but I thought the cancer was contained. And when she went to Mexico, she was there with the children And I got the news completely without knowing any of the details. So for a few days, we didn't know what was happening. Where is she? Who's bringing her home? When is the funeral? When is the this? When is the that? And finally, I left a call. I left a message on the phones of the children saying, please give me a call. I know this is a difficult moment, but there are things that must be done, and I would like to help if I can. I was then called a day later and told that, yes, that it was on that Tuesday. This was on a Friday evening, that the funeral was going to take place that Tuesday, and that it would start at noon, and that with all the people being invited, that it was, I was to be one of these people delivering the eulogy, and that my time would be at somewhere around 12:31. And I said, fine. And knowing this, I began to put my thoughts together. That Saturday, Bush declared he's coming. He would be there. That Sunday, I began to change my speech. Not to be rude or to be attacking, but to integrate this moment into what needed to be said. And then that Monday morning, I got a call, and I was told that the invitation had been extended to me, had been pulled. I was uninvited. A woman by the name of Skinner and a reverend by the name of Lawrence was the one who called me to tell me that I was invited. And when that call came, I called and spoke to one of the children. And I said, these are the events, and I need to be counseled as to how this has come about. And I was told that I would get a call shortly, and it would all be clarified. And then when the final call came, they were sorry, but the withdrawing of the invitation would stand, and that if I came down, they would find a place for me in the church, but I would not speak. And I did not go at all. I did not know how to do that. What struck me was on the day of the ceremony, I saw how the altar was adorned. I saw who sat there. And as the camera moved about, I saw who was sitting in the audience. And I saw all of the power of the oppressor represented on the stage. And all those who fought for the victories that this nation was experiencing and enjoying sat in the outhouse, sat out in the field, sat removed. And if it had not been for Lowry, President Carter, and for Maya Angelou, we would have had no voice and no representation at all. Some ministers who were quite angry at all this said, well, you come on down here and we have to talk to the press. And I said, talk to the press about what? It's about this. We cannot let it stand. I said, I don't think that's appropriate. These are the children of my friend. These are the children of the movement. Where did we let them get caught? Why was Bernice giving this kind of sermon? How did you let Reverend Long become the minister of choice? Why wasn't Ebenezer Baptist Church where Dr. King preached? And before we go public and begin to vent our anger, let us understand what role we played in this capitulation that has led to this moment. And let us try first to repair it rather than to go into public discourse. When do we sit in a circle of healing? When do we begin to talk about getting back to where we lost stride? How do we fix this? Not how do we play the vanity game and get off on going public and talking about how I was crucified. You know, it's what it is. And there's a way in which we have to do this that not only prevents, I don't know that there'll be another moment quite like that, because Dr. King and Malcolm X and Daniel Hammond Fuxley were so rare that to be a part of the final ceremony of their departure is a rare moment in history. But I think that it goes along with what I've been saying here. What role have we played in letting all this happen? And where were we? What were we doing that had us so distracted? How can it be this way? How did you priests and ministers let the evangelical right-wing Christian forces co-opt the greater truth about Christianity and the philosophy of liberation? And how did you all let that happen? And where are your voices in opposition publicly? Everybody has a part in this. Everybody has something to look at. And I think it's a collective experience. And that's why I think rather than sitting here drifting, we got to talk about this. Not just where we failed and where you failed. And we got to come out of this discourse and this discussion, not just talking about it, but say, here's where we go. And take courage in the fact that we can turn this around. Because the truth of the matter is, we are the only ones that can turn this around. Nothing and no one else can do it. Nothing.
We'll rehouse the homeless in Buckingham Palace. Start at the bottom, work down to the top. Stop the city, rebuild the forest. Cancel the rent, nick all the cops. Be reasonable, demand the impossible now. Be reasonable, demand the impossible now. We'll turn all the motorways into canals. Close all the Aldermastons down. All differences equal. Systems for people, not the other way around. Be reasonable, demand the impossible now. Be reasonable, demand the impossible now. We'll spring all the animals, but for the clowns in the circus bourgeoisie. Where the rich sing the blues till their trousers fall down, then give you the price of a nice cup of tea. Be reasonable, demand the impossible now. Be reasonable, demand the impossible now. Rose gardens and hospitals, playgrounds and schools, blood sunflowers on every street. Do what you like, cause you like what you do, like autumn each year at your feet. Be reasonable, demand the impossible now. Be reasonable, demand the impossible now. No master, no landlord, no flag, no guru, no gauleiter, no commissar. Just justice and poetry, and jam on it too. When they are losing charge,
no flag, no guru, no Gauleiter, no commissar. Just justice and poetry, and jam on it too. When I ask who's in charge here, we all say,
we are.
Be reasonable, demand the impossible now. Be reasonable, demand the impossible now. Oh, be reasonable. Be reasonable. Be reasonable and demand the impossible. And demand the impossible. And demand the impossible now.
Rob Johnson with Be Reasonable, a rousing little number. Well, now we reach a seminal point in the show. It is, of course, an idea central to the Vox Pop project to feature stuff made not by us but by listeners. And, well, what we have now is just that. First up, Penny Turner is an environmental journalist and activist living in Greece. In fact, she's lived there for about 25 years. And she has recorded this piece for us about the appalling environmental mayhem perpetrated against the Greek landscape by the State Power Corporation, the DEI.
Whenever I have time, I set off to explore the wilder parts of Greece with my horse George. I suppose my main reason for doing this is to see the Greek wilderness before it disappears, and in some way to chronicle what is there. I often find that it isn't only the countryside that is being unsustainably exploited, but also the people who live there. What follows is a description of what is going on in a part of northwest Greece. Kozani is the nearest town of any size. I had stopped the night at the refuge of the Ptolemaida Alpine Club, which is high up on Mount Sinachiko. I had been hoping to hear wolves, because 2 weeks before I had heard them up there. I didn't hear any, but I did meet some members of the Ptolemaida Alpine Club. They did their level best to persuade me not to take my intended route, which, on the map, looked like tracks and small country roads leading to Ayi Theodori, a small village where I planned to cross the main road from Kozani to Thessaloniki. They, with the benefit of local knowledge, said that it wasn't like that at all. They tried to persuade me to go home the way I'd come, via Siatista. But would I listen? Of course not. Had a map, didn't I? Why take any notice of local knowledge? And that's how I came to visit what is, without doubt, the worst place in Greece, and quite high on the list of dreadful places worldwide. Things started off well enough, but soon the roads and the map failed to correspond in any way at all. I was on a quiet asphalt road somewhere. Eventually I found someone. Oh, don't go that way, you'll get lost in DEI. That's the State Power Company, they said. I was being warned again, but I still didn't get it. I began to understand when I crossed a bridge that led onto the road that they told me was the only one that went to Ayi Theodori. On this country back road, I was surprised to find there was a constant stream of lorries travelling at insane speed. There was no other traffic. Well, it was obvious George and I couldn't travel along this road. except that there was no other road or path or way to get off this one. Now we're on it. Just then, a factory siren sounded, and the number of lorries immediately got less. By chance, we had reached the road just as the day's work came to an end. Thank goodness, things were bad enough without them. I walked, leading George. Great pools of black sludge were everywhere along the road, draining into various unfortunate streams and rivers. Soon, on either side of this public road, there were massive, deafening, clanking conveyor belts full of lignite, huge and terrifying. In some places, we were forced to go down a kind of tunnel between whole spaghetti junctions of conveyor belts. George was gloomily hysterical. He trembled and stuck close to me. After we had gone a good many kilometres, we found an exit, thank goodness. After crossing a ravine, we set off across barren grey landscape populated by monstrous, unidentifiable, rusting metal things. We got to a village. There seemed to be no one there. Then a woman called to me. "We saw you coming," she said. "You will eat with us." And that's how I got to know what's happening in Kletos. And what's happening in Kletos is awful. It's not just the physical dreadfulness of the surroundings, unstable-looking slag heaps looming above the village, views of chimneys belching deadly smoke, nothing beautiful anywhere. It is also the appalling conditions of daily life. Although Kletos is some distance from the conveyor belts, their ceaseless clanking kept George neurotically running about all night. "Oh, we got used to the noise," said Maria. "Your eyes are watering. Do they sting?" "Yes," I said. "It's the smoke and dust," she said. "We're used to it, but visitors always get runny eyes." George was in a place that seemed to be full of grass, and in the dusk I couldn't see any problem with it. He just wouldn't settle and graze. In the morning, I saw why. All of the grass, indeed all of everything, is coated with sticky, grey, tarry, smelly substance. Disgusting. I assumed that the villagers must be workers for Dei, and that's why they lived there. This was not so. Some were, but most were farmers, except stuff doesn't really grow and stock doesn't really prosper. I'm not surprised. Why was the village almost abandoned? Well, about 15 years ago, the villagers had been informed that the lignite below their houses and fields was needed by Dei. They were given the compensation then, 15 years ago, and told that they would be given a new site for their village. This new site is only now available. Some people have already gone there. Some have gone elsewhere. Many, according to Maria, cannot move to the new Kletos because the compensation they were given 15 years ago has somehow got spent in the meantime, and they've got no money to build on the site that they've now finally been given. The emotional stress of a life in this kind of limbo must be considerable. Anthula and her boyfriend and her mother Maria were glad to be going. At last. "It's much healthier where we're going, and we got a lovely new house." Grandma wasn't so sure, but accepted that there was no choice. In the early morning, I went to photograph the hell that George and I had passed through the previous evening. Some gentlemen from Dei told me that it was forbidden to take photos. I forcibly expressed surprise about this. I had seen no signs anywhere, nothing on the map. But I can see why they might not want photos taken. I walked back across the desolate wasteland that had once been the village grazing grounds. It doesn't exactly get light in the morning at Kletos. It just gradually stops being dark. The dust and the smoke form a constant pall of murk. It's like being in Mexico City, without the amenities. Anthula volunteered to show me the way to get onto a smaller road without going back onto the death trap of that public road. I led George through the crumbling remains of the once fine, prosperous village of Kletos. A little old lady asked Anthula to stop so she could talk to me. "I wanted to say," she said, "that you mustn't judge us from the state of our village. When we came here, we made it so pretty with flowers and trees. But we've known we have to leave for so long, there seemed no point, so we've let it go, rather. We came as refugees, you know, and now we are refugees again." The first people who lived in Cletus had come from the Black Sea area when the populations were exchanged with Turkey. At least, I said to Anthula, the old people will be with their friends in the new village, a community, all together. Well, no, she said. You see, there's a lottery for the plot, to make it fairer. And some people not from Cletus have bought some of the plots. And the new Cletus covers a very big area. And do people get counselling, psychological help? I asked Anthula. She gave me a look. Well, silly question, really. George and I were both coated in the same revolting gunk as the grass. Cold water and soap had no effect on it. Those people who live there all the time, what must their lungs be like? Now, as I read this in 2006, all the people who lived in Cletus will have been moved. The new Cletus was already on the map in 2005, though the old Cletus was marked too. In the next edition of the map, the old Cletus will not be marked. This is what has happened with all the other villages which have been similarly removed. In this way, the state can pretend that these places, and the people who lived in them, never existed. The village of Cletus, and the whole history of the people who lived there, will have been obliterated.
What a jolly little ditty we had there to go front and back of Penny's piece. We were all up on the table here, swigging down bottles of Retsina and throwing crockery over our shoulders. Anyway, I must say that Penny was unduly modest there when she said that whenever she has time she explores the wilder parts of Greece with her horse. In fact, she's an intrepid horse person, having once completed a single 1,600-kilometre ride across Greece. In fact, she goes on these prodigious treks across the remotest parts of that country on a regular basis, living stark naked in caves and feeding off juniper berries and God knows what. And she writes some pretty amazing stuff, for which she has duly won awards, including the BBC Best Wildlife Writing Award. She writes regularly for the Athens News, which you can access on the internet at... I won't go through all those wobble-yous again. We'll post a link on the Vox Pop site. And if you take a look at the archive page on our site, you'll find another piece there also by Penny, which we somehow didn't get around to using. Next we have a piece made by Spike. She works for Community Radio in Manchester. We seem to have rather a lot about Manchester in this show. We seem strangely drawn to it. Anyway, this is about the Working Class Movement Library in Salford. There'll be another link there too, which was started by Ruth and Eddie Throw, who were dismayed at how poorly recorded the history of the labour movement is. And so they set about doing something about it.
What is now the Working Class Movement Library was started by Ruth and Eddie Froh in the 1950s. Ruth explains how it began.
When Eddie and I first started taking interest in books, we had no real intention of collecting a library about labour movement. But as it grew, as our interest developed, we realised that the labour movement was very badly documented and was never looked on as a subject in public libraries. So we directed our collecting more and more towards working class history, which is very much bound up with the labour movement.
Ruth and Eddie's collection soon took over their Stretford home. Michael Herbert, one of the library's trustees, remembers visiting there.
When I first got to know Ruth and Eddie in about 1980, and I went round to their house on King's Road, the whole house by then was full of books, every room virtually, I think every room in fact, was full of books and even the outhouse and the garage. So the house had ceased to be a house. It was now a library. It happened to have a couple of people working in it, living in it. And it was visited by people regularly. Ruth and Eddie would put them up, look after them, show them the books, help them with their research, provide cups of tea and coffee and Ruth's homemade buns. So it was a very, as a young man, it was a very welcoming place, and I was made to feel very comfortable and welcome.
The library is about showing how ordinary people have combined in organisations over the past 200 years to bring about social and political progress, and covers a wide range of subject matter.
So we start in the 1790s, roughly, and cover the radical period. We've got things on the Chartist movement of the 1830s and 40s, the socialist movement of the 1890s and onwards, trade unionism, women's movement, particularly the suffragette movement of the early 1900s, and then the later revival of feminism in the 1970s, Spanish Civil War, support for the campaign against the Vietnam War, CND, and other peace movements.
That's great for Vietnam.
Yeah. So I did a very broad range of material, and sometimes single-issue campaigns, sometimes mass political movements, sometimes trade union movements. So they can be like, they say campaigns of millions, like the campaign against the war. The campaign can be campaigns by a few people, which have been influential.
The library eventually outgrew its original location in Ruth and Eddie's home and moved to Jubilee House in Salford Crescent.
When the library moved here in 87 and was invited to move to this building by Salford Council, Ruth and Eddie came with the collection and literally lived in the library here for a while until they had to move out. But they still maintain the same ethos, and it's an ethos that we really see as important, that the library is open, that we're welcoming, and we still provide tea and coffee and biscuits. And if you're really lucky, some buns made by Ruth. And marmalade. You must mention the marmalade that people make to help give and raise funds.
The library is not just a resource for academics and professors.
If you happen to be an academic, it is a primary resource and has been made very good use of by professors of different nationalities. Of course it's an academic resource. On the other hand, we don't want it to be regarded only as an academic resource. We would like people to feel that they can walk in and get help with what they're interested in, with their ordinary lives, in their work, in their trade union, in their home conditions, in their lives.
As well as visiting the library to see the collections of books and other resources, guided tours can be arranged by appointment or on occasional National Heritage Open Days.
Here, which is where we always start the library, is the Thomas Paine room. Thomas Paine was probably Britain's, or certainly England's, most important radical. He went to America in 1774, became very important in the American Revolution, wrote a lot of pamphlets, some of which we have here, supporting the cause of the emerging United States against Britain. He came back to Britain after the victorious American Revolution and began writing about how Britain should be changed.
This is a very interesting one, the Analytical Review. This was a 1790 journal in which Mary Wollstonecraft wrote. And she was the woman who wrote the Rights of Women, or Woman, actually. That's a Chartist journal, Ernest Jones. And all these, New Moral World, that's the Robert Owen, who was influential in initiating the cooperative movement. All these journals really took over Paine's ideas and developed them over the 19th century. And from the library's point of view, we boast that we can supply any radical journal of the 19th century, either in original or in duplication. You know, we're very lucky. This collection of books we have in our bedroom in Kingsley Road. This is we call it the GMB room because the GMB union paid for the shelving. All this wall-mounted shelving, which we have to have because otherwise it's too heavy on the floors, was paid for by our friends' organisation. Otherwise we'd never have it. But in here you've got all those little boilermakers, we've got the weavers, we've got the tailor and garment workers.
When the unions wrote to people, they would keep a copy. You know, like people send an email now and don't bother keeping a copy. So, which is brilliant for historians, because then you've got a copy of the letter they wrote about something or other. So that's all the bureaucracy of the union is here.
You can get more from those letters than you can from the executive minutes, which are in these big books, because they didn't put anything in which was likely to be of use to anybody else.
Unbelievably dusty.
All done in the most beautiful copper tape writing.
Yeah. So it's going to be one of the real problems of reconstructing stuff from now, because people send emails, they don't bother keeping copy. People set up websites, they don't bother keeping a copy as it changes. Whereas with great thing about printed material is, if you're lucky, and it's on decent, and this is quite posh paper, it'll last for a long time, you know, several hundred years, perhaps more. And because people wrote letters, that you can reconstruct, if you're lucky, reconstruct what happened. But I think at the moment. And another disaster for historians is the growth of digital cameras, because people take lots of photos, but they don't bother running them off, or they just print them on cheap paper.
Yeah.
So in 50 years' time, people won't have many photos. Whereas before, you've got them on negatives, you've even got glass negatives that you can reconstruct them from.
There is much more to the library than simply books.
One of the things that Eddie and I found very rapidly was that working class history is not just in books, it's in pamphlets, it's in leaflets, election addresses, and also in the badges and the emblems and the banners, which I always say we don't keep, but in fact we never throw away, and all the other increasingly usable things like t-shirts with slogans on, it's all part of the history, so that it's expanding the whole time, and we can take people round and show them what their history consists of without them necessarily wanting to research anything, just out of interest.
Did you alter the face of the city?
Make any change in the world you found?
Or did you observe all the warnings?
Did you read the trespass notices? Did you keep off the grass? Did you shuffle off the pavement just to let your betters pass? Did you learn to keep your mouth shut? Were you seen and never heard? Did you learn to be obedient and jump to at a word, jump to at a word, jump to at a word?
Salford was home to radical singer-songwriter Ewan McCall, and the Working Class Movement Library has a vast collection of revolutionary and radical music.
We have a good collection about Ewan McCall, and we've got a major resource on the website. But we also have a lot of folk records from Topic Records, a lot of vinyl, lots of Red Army choirs, but also other stuff as well. And we also are trying to collect more modern stuff. For instance, recently Alice Nutter, who was in Chumbawamba, is now trying to become a playwright. She very kindly brought in a collection of Chumbawamba material, and we'd be interested in similar material, CDs, but also other stuff collected with music, such as the tickets, the posters. Maybe personal accounts of people who were involved in bands. So we take a wide view on music, and music has been a very important part. We're not just a political library, we're also a social and cultural library. And in the past and in the present, music has played a major part in creating people's consciousness, in taking movements forward. And the songs that have come out of those movements, for instance, the Marseillaise was a revolutionary song before it became the French national anthem. The songs that come out of political movements can resonate, and they're an important part of a historian's work.
Sick of being on the outside, in the street. Sick of being last in the queue. Sick of being looked through as if I'm not there. The original invisible man.
The Working Class Movement Library is about the future as well as the past.
It's not just as a collection for its own sake. You know, we definitely see that the collection has an educational role, and the history we document and look after here raises the questions which I think are still pertinent to people's lives about who controls society, who controls the wealth, who controls the power, and what future will the people have for their own children or grandchildren. I think those are all questions which still inevitably preoccupy people. And what we have here is a way of people looking to the past, seeing how people answered those questions in the past, not necessarily a guide to the future, but you can learn from the past, and if you're lucky, you may possibly avoid repeating the mistakes of the past.
The library welcomes donations of very recent working class and protest history.
It's not a sterile or dead collection. So if people, listeners have collections of material they think might be of interest to us, essentially based around paper rather than the internet or websites, I think we'll leave it to other collections with more money and academic resources to collect those. But we're still interested if people have collections, and often there may be collections that their family have kept in a cellar or attic for many years. Sometimes people literally walk in with a bag full of stuff that their family might have had for a century that they bring to us just by ringing the doorbell. So we continue to have material come in, and we are interested in new stuff, but space is limited, and then we have to be sadly more selective than we used to be.
So what kind of new stuff would you want? How do you decide what's worth keeping, basically?
It's almost impossible to answer. Anything which reflects the labour movement, working class activity, strikes, demonstrations, trade union activity. Increasingly we are getting trade union archives because the pattern of trade unions is changing, and as the smaller unions become amalgamated and join up with the larger unions, they often don't know what to do with their material, so we take that in. Most of our ephemeral material, the sort of material which is really museum rather than library, has come because people don't know what to do with it and can't bear to throw it away. And that's right. I can't bear to throw it away either.
"Where are you going?" says Miller to Munger. "We may not tell you," says Johnson to Judd. "We're going to Mill," says Jack to Algiers. "We're going to the factory," says little Ned Ludd. "And what will you do there?" says Miller to Munger.
"Do you swear to tell no one?" says Johnson to Judd. "We'll break the machinery, improve the scenery, meet in the greenery after," says Ludd. "And how will you break 'em?" says Miller to Munger. "Spit with us, we'll show you," says Johnson to Judd. "With pikes and with hammers, with fire and spanners, to teach 'em some manners," says General Ludd. "Die, die, die, de dum, die, de dum, die. 'Cause and if we don't break 'em, our lives they will take 'em, our craft, our cottage, our village as well. No freedom or laughter to come after, but the servant and master in a factory hell." So the door was kicked in, and the frames were all broken, and the owner was welcomed and raised the alarm, and the yeoman came riding, but we were in hiding, the people providing to keep us from harm. From Lots up to Lancashire, Yorkshire to Derbyshire, 1811 to 1813, Ludd's army enlisted and the people resisted the march of the poor money-making machine. Die, die, die-de-dum, die-de-dum, die. "How now shall we stop it?" says owner to roller, "with spies and with soldiers, this Tory to wing. We'll hang every breaker and Luddite, host, taker, transport, troublemakers." And that's what they did. 14 hung on a beam, ugliest justice that you've ever seen. 50 in all who took a long fall in the rising against the machine. And that made a
hated slavery, hungered and homeless, and bowed to the boss whose factories killed them and crippled their children. And all for the worship of profit and law. Utility. They say the future will be what the engine of progress demands. But luck called humanity back to reality. We weave our destiny with our own hands. All hands that are ready to hold a line steady, to pull down the fences or pull up a crop, unlock the laboratory, build a home in the treetop. And some call us vandals, some call us hooligans, some call us Lennox, and some rent a mob. But we're standing up proud and we're shouting out loud. For the sake of our family, let's finish this job. And when the job's done, and the long wars are over, and we've all
Okay, that was Ned Ludd by Seize the Day, and before that you heard Spike's documentary feature on the Working Class Movement Library. I'll make a point of visiting that the next time I'm in Manchester. My brother lives there, so I guess I'll get there sometime. Now, both those pieces by Penny and Spike are shining examples of what we are looking for. That's stuff put together by our listeners. Maybe you are involved in some kind of campaigning work, maybe some environmental stuff or some interesting community work or some interesting alternative social or economic initiatives. Let's schemes are something that fascinates me. So if any of you have had any experience of them, let's hear from you, if you excuse the pun. Anyway, Sebastian, how did your concert go yesterday?
Well, it was marvelous. We had about 200 people in our crowd, and it worked out perfectly. Huh. It's really great.
Brilliant, yeah. He's been very modest. Sebastian's just signed up to a new band, and they're quite well known in the area, in this neck of the woods. What are they called again?
We're called Drowned in Dreams. If you want to see something about the band, we got a homepage. It's Drowned in Dreams, all written together. .com.
Uh-huh. Okay. And what sort of stuff is it that they do?
It's, really heavy metal. We got some, calm passages, but we are mainly heavy metal.
Yeah.
So.
And the lyrics are kind of very, what? Kind of politically oriented, or what? How are they?
Particularly, yes. Hmm. We got some political songs, but also got things that are, some more psychic. But we are keen on our songs being or having really meaning.
That's good. Yeah. Okay. Great. So he's on the way up now. He'll soon be famous, and you'll see him on the telly and everything. But remember that you first heard him here on Vox Populi. Anyway, we'd better quit now because we've already run to about 2.5 hours. I think definitely time to stop. We'll try to get our next show out early in the new year, and thereafter, hopefully, at 6-week intervals, we'll see. Anyway, thanks for listening, and in case we're accused of being a bit melancholy in our choice of music, here's something decidedly cheerful. This is Death and Destruction by Rosie Lugosi.